At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Over on patreon.com, we have got a lot of new exclusive Bowery Boys audio for our super fans, including, of course, our regular Patreon-only show called Side Streets.
And at the $5.5 level and above, I've got a whole episode of bonus scenes from my recent Stories of Flushing show, with many more interesting bits of history. Then at the $10 Gilded Age level, you'll get audio from my interview with author Eric J. Dolan, recorded at the New York Historical Society. We're talking privateers, pirates, and the American Revolution.
And that's not all. At that same level, you also get exclusive merchandise, new shows a couple of days before everybody else, and you get all of our podcasts ad-free.
You won't even hear this message. That's all on patreon.com/Bowery Boys.
Your support helps us keep the show running. Thank you so much.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Bond. James Bond. 007 is a masculine film icon. He's handsome, debonair, and dangerous. He completely epitomizes the French idea of savoir-faire, the ability to know what to do in any situation. Bond is so darn manly, it'd be easy to think that he was purely the creation of author Ian Fleming's imagination. But in fact, Bond was inspired by a real-life World War II spy, and his life and career was even more Bond-like than James Bond. My guest today on the show has written a biography of the real-life inspiration for James Bond. His name is Larry Loftus, and he's the author of the book Into the Lion's Mouth, The True Story of Dusko Popov, World War II Spy, Patriot, and the Real-Life Inspiration for James Bond. Today on the show, we talk about Dusko Popov and his career as a double agent during World War II. Larry and I discuss how Dusko got involved with spying, the insanely dangerous missions he went on, and the real-life encounter between him and Ian Fleming that inspired one of popular culture's most iconic characters. Really fascinating show. When you're done, check out the show notes at aom.is/bond for links to, you know, explore more into this topic. So without further ado, Larry Loftus and Into the Lion's Mouth. Larry Loftus, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brett.
So you have a new book out that was just a fantastic read. It's a true story, but it read like a thriller. It's called Into the Lion's Mouth, The True Story of Dusko Popov, World War II Spy, Patriot, and the Real Life Inspiration for James Bond. When I was, I had no idea this guy existed. And when I finished the book, I was like, why don't more people know about this guy? Because he contributed so much to the Allied cause during World War II. So I'm curious, how did you get started researching Popov's espionage career and his connection to Ian Fleming's James Bond?
Well, I actually stumbled across it. I was working on basically just an historical fiction novel and wanted to do espionage because I like the area, I like the genre. And so I thought, you know, I better do some research to find out what actual spies did so that my story is believable. So I started Googling and researching best spy ever, greatest spy, most daring spy, and all roads led to Popov. His name just kept popping up again and again. So then I started focusing on him and researching him. And I quickly found out, holy cow, this guy did more in real life than I'm making up for my fictional character. So I switched then just to focusing on him. And then, you know, my fiction novel basically became a nonfiction. But he did so many things, so many unbelievable things, so many cool things that it does read like a thriller novel.
Right. I mean, it reads like a James Bond movie script. You're like, there's like scenes and it's like, that's just straight out of James Bond, how it happened.
Yep. Well, there's a reason for that, which I know we'll get to in a moment.
Right. So let's get some background on Popov because he's an interesting character. He was a double agent for the United Kingdom and for the Germans, but he was primarily working for the United Kingdom, the Allies. But he was this Serbian playboy from Yugoslavia. So how did he end up becoming a double agent during World War II for the Allies and for the Nazis?
Well, he was not a double agent for the Germans. He was a straight agent for the Germans. He was a double agent for us.
Gotcha.
For the UK and then for the US when he came over here. But he came from a wealthy family in Yugoslavia, And he, like us, was a lawyer. He earned a law degree at University of Belgrade and then went to Freiburg in Germany to get a doctorate in law. And when he was there, he meets his best friend, Johann Jepsen, a German who is brilliant and just becomes basically his best friend. They both hated the Nazis. And they just hit it off well together. Johnny was very wealthy, came from a very wealthy shipping family, which still exists today, the Jepsen family. And then Popoff was expelled from Germany right after he graduated in 1937. He was expelled for making derogatory remarks against the Third Reich. And so he was kicked out of the country. And then when war breaks out, he suddenly gets a telegram from Johnny that says he needs to meet immediately. And Johnny's coming to Yugoslavia to meet with him and says, you know, meet me on this date. And then basically lays out the cards and says, I'm recruited. I'm a German recruiter. I'm in the AWACS, which was the military intelligence for the Germans. And he said, I need your help. And this is his best friend. He said, I need your help. It won't be a big deal. I need you to do a little work for me. Just go to some cocktail parties, gather some information. And so Popoff was torn. I mean, he despises the Nazi, but he knows that Johnny is stuck because if you're in Germany and you're a German, you either join the military or you're executed for treason. So he knew his best friend was in a bind. So he said, okay, I'll help you. So he's essentially recruited by Johnny into the ABWAR as a German agent. And then immediately goes to the British and says, hey, I've just been recruited. I'm a German spy. How would you like all of my information? I'd love to be a British double agent. So that's what happens. He goes to the embassy and they said, yeah. And then they send him to London and he gets vetted. And from there on, it's history.
It's history. And that's where all the exciting adventures happen. So one thing I thought was great about the book is I learned a lot about espionage during World War II, because I think that's an overlooked aspect of the war, or most wars actually. Because, you know, everyone knows about the Battle of the Bulge, Normandy, Midway, but those battles relied on intelligence.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us about the status of spies during World War II or any war actually, and why that status made the job so dangerous?
Well, it's critical, number one. And if you've seen recently, there are a lot of books out about even the spies that George Washington used and how critical that was in the Revolutionary War. The spies are useful because you need information. You need accurate information so you know where to send your troops, where to keep your troops out of, and so forth. And when it gets messed up, like Dunkirk, then people die. So the spies, every side always uses spies. I mean, they try to be under the radar and invisible, but they're out there. And if they're caught, of course, they're tortured for their information and then executed. Spies are not covered under the Geneva Convention. They're not covered. So they're on their own if they get caught. So Popoff and every other spy, if you agree to become a spy, you are taking on the most dangerous job ever, because it's not just that they're going to kill you. They are going to kill you, but they're going to torture you to get all of your information, all of the codes, all of the other spies that are involved, so that they can then, go after your whole network. So on the German side, and he ended up working for so many different agents. On the German side, he's recruited as an ABWAR agent, which is the German military intelligence. But then you also have, as soon as he joins later when he's in Lisbon, the Gestapo want to use him. And the SD, it's a long German name, but that's the Nazi intelligence. They want to use him. So essentially, even on the German side, he has three masters. And then on the British side, he has two masters. He has MI5, which is counterintelligence, kind of like our FBI, but it's counterintelligence domestic. And then you have MI6, which is straight foreign intelligence. And then later he comes over he's loaned by the British to the U.S. and he works for the FBI as an agent, essentially. Not a formal agent, but they called him an informant. But for all practical purposes, he's an agent. So he ends up, essentially having like six masters, if you will.
And so, I mean, what was the incentive for these guys to become spies if it was so dangerous and they weren't protected by the laws of war?
Well, for Popoff, it was all about, patriotism. And that's why it's in the title, World War II Spy Patriot, because he's from a neutral country. Yugoslavia is neutral when World War II breaks out. And so he's got Germany on one side, he's got the UK on the other side, and his best friend is German. He just came from Germany. He was expelled, though. He absolutely despises the Nazis. And he saw what Churchill saw and everyone else that was paying attention, that this is a madman. Hitler's a madman. And that if he's not stopped, millions of people are going to die. So Popoff sees that because he was there. I mean, he was in Germany when they started the crackdown. He was arrested by the Gestapo. He was thrown in prison. And he would have been executed, but for something that, and I won't spoil it in the book, but something happens that gets him out, that springs him out. But had that not occurred, he would have rotted in prison and probably died there and probably been executed.
And I mean, did Popoff sort of have, I mean, did his personality suit this? Like, was there something about his personality was like, yeah, this is exactly what I do. It's dangerous. I love risk. I mean, was there something about
no doubt. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it was the perfect storm to create the perfect spy, because you've got a guy, and it's not just that he's patriotic, and it's not just that essentially it's easy for us. You have good and evil, and Hitler's evil, so you're going to fight against Hitler. But his country's neutral. He doesn't have to do this. He can just stay in his neutral country. He had a wonderful life. He was a lawyer. He had a great law practice. He had great clients. Came from a wealthy family. He had a very nice yacht. So he didn't have to do this, but part of it was patriotism, and he wanted to stop the evil that he saw in Hitler. And then the other part, if he's going to do it, what better way to do it than as a spy? Because this guy was brilliant. He had a doctorate in law. He spoke five languages. He was cultured. The Germans and the British both loved him because he was so cultured. He could go into any setting, any society setting. He could meet with prime ministers. He could meet with kings, and did, the king of Yugoslavia, and did. So he was a guy, but he had ice water in his veins. And so he could pull it off and did. But he was so cultured. He was a great athlete. He was a world-class, I don't know if it was world-class, but he was a top-notch water polo player, horseback rider. He'd won two shooting contests. He was a good boxer. I mean, this guy just had all of the skills to be the perfect spy. And he liked danger because it was exciting. He wanted to do something. He was a lawyer, but he didn't really, kind of like us. He wasn't really all that crazy about it, because after a while, just office work becomes drudgery. And he wanted excitement.
Right.
And he got it in spades.
So yeah, it's starting to sound like James Bond a bit. And the guy was also good looking, and he had like
charming, incredible. And this is all over the MI5 files, which used to be classified and now are declassified, but it's all over the files, all of his personality. He was incredibly charming. He was handsome. Again, he was athletic, highly intelligent, but he knew how to treat women. He knew how to charm women. He was socially, extremely socially skilled. So he was just, he was James Bond before James Bond. That's why Ian Fleming based it on him.
Right. So he started doing these missions for the Germans and the British, but he ended up in Lisbon in Portugal,
right.
Which played an important role for both German and British spies. Why is that?
Both during World War II, there's really only two countries that are neutral, ostensibly neutral, on continental Europe, and that's Spain and Portugal. And Spain was only really ostensibly neutral because Hitler had actually provided Franco with military equipment and planes and so forth during their civil war. So they were really secretly siding with Germany. But Portugal was completely neutral, and Lisbon and secondly Madrid, those were the two hubs where every country sent their spies and diplomats. So in both cities, Lisbon and Madrid, you would have hundreds of diplomats that were really spies. I mean, diplomats and spies embedded within the diplomats. So I got the actual embassy list of the personnel It was in the Portuguese secret police files, but it shows the actual embassy list of both sets, the German set and the British set that are in Lisbon. And I'm going down the list. Okay, this guy's a spy. This guy's Gestapo. This guy's SD. This guy's Abwehr. Top-off supervisors on the German side. Von Karstorff is listed there, and he's just listed basically as an attaché. So it was the hub. It was where all of the countries sent spies. We sent military people there. So there would be military attachés there, diplomats, spies, and so they were all, it was the bottleneck. That's where they all went.
Right. And then also Lisbon was like the perfect background, adding to this sort of spy mystique, because it's kind of a exotic, romantic place. There's casinos, fancy hotels.
Oh, no question. Actually, if you look at the map, you'll see Lisbon, which is a beautiful city. And then you'll see just to the west of it, you'll see Estoril, which is a suburb. And the best way to describe it is just think of the French Riviera. I mean, it is essentially the Portuguese Riviera and was built that way. It was a small fishing town, Estoril was, that they decided around the turn of the century to build into this beautiful resort area that would compete with the French Riviera, and they did. So they built the Palacio, which is a world-class hotel, still is. They built this massive casino, which was the biggest in Europe at the time. You've got the ocean there, so they've got this beautiful beach. You've got a castle right there on the beach. It is a beautiful climate. You just had all of these things that really made it the perfect destination. And they built shops and restaurants and so forth. And a lot of royalty were going there to vacation. So they built these beautiful homes for the royalty to stay in. So it was just an incredibly romantic place for espionage to happen. There were a couple of books that I used that gave me the background on Lisbon, and it's just fascinating.
Right. And this, in Lisbon, this is where Ian Fleming bumped into Popoff, correct?
Correct.
So it's interesting. A lot of people don't know that Ian Fleming, before he was a spy writer, was actually part of naval intelligence, I guess, for the British.
Correct. Correct. He was in British intelligence. You really have three groups. You have MI6, foreign intelligence. You have MI5, domestic intelligence. And then you have the British naval intelligence. And in naval intelligence director, the director was Admiral John Godfrey. There are two boards that supervise Popoff and all of the spies. There was the planning board at the top, which was called the W board. And that had Admiral Godfrey on there and Stuart Menzies, who was the MI6 director, which Ian Fleming would call M, but he went by C. Fleming, of course, had to change it, but he went by C. But anyway, so you had this overarching supervisory board that does the planning. And then you had a second board, which was called the Double Cross Committee, which was much more involved and basically handled the day-to-day affairs of these guys. So everything Popoff did on a daily basis, the Double Cross Committee knew about it, had planned, and so forth. Well, Admiral Godfrey was one of only a couple of people that actually was on both the W board and the Double Cross Committee. So Godfrey knew everything about Popoff. I mean, had to okay it. I mean, he was in the decision-making group for both boards there. Fleming was his personal assistant. He was his secretary. So as his personal assistant, he was his right-hand man. Fleming was the ear for everything that Godfrey heard. So in the summer of 1941, Godfrey's going to go over to the United States to meet with President Roosevelt and try to persuade him to start a foreign intelligence, basically like to mimic MI6, because the U.S. doesn't have one. All we have at the time is the FBI. And Hoover wanted to control everything, including foreign intelligence. And the British said that's idiotic, and they didn't trust Hoover anyway. So Godfrey went over to meet with FDR to persuade him to start a foreign intelligence like the MI6, which became for the U.S., the OSS, which was the forerunner to the CIA. When he takes this trip, of course, he takes his right-hand man with him, Ian Fleming. So Fleming goes with him, and Fleming meets with the other underlings, and basically Fleming essentially writes the charter to the OSS, which becomes our CIA. Most people don't realize that Fleming had a connection to our intelligence as well. When they come back, both going over and coming back, they stay in Lisbon on a layover. And when they come back is when Fleming runs into Popov. Godfrey knows Popov was involved in an incredibly labyrinthine scam to basically steal the Germans blind through money laundering, if you can believe it. So as part of this scam, Popov works this incredible feat to essentially steal all this money from him, which he does. And of course, Godfrey had to approve this. It was called the Midas plan. And so Godfrey knows all about it and presumably informed Ian Fleming of what was going on. Well, Popov gets the money right as Fleming is coming back. And when Fleming is staying in Lisbon on the way back, he knows that Popov just got all of this money. And $40,000, which in today's, you know, would be like, you know, $600,000 in cash. So Fleming follows Popov, and Popov kept it on him because he couldn't trust that amount of money in the safe, in the hotel safe, and he couldn't trust leaving in his room because his room was always searched by different countries, different spies, and so forth. So he kept it on him, and he is followed by Ian Fleming. This is about August 1 is about the date that this happened, 1941. So he follows Popov from the Palacio, where Fleming had stayed in the Palacio on the prior trip. And there's this hotel spy bar that's kind of famous where they both went. So he follows him from the Palacio to get a drink. And he's just shadowing him, you know. But Popov notices, hey, there's this guy following me. And then to dinner and then to the casino. So when he's in the casino, he knows that Fleming is watching. Well, if I can segue back to Casino Royale, have you read that?
Yeah, book? I have. Yep.
If you look at Casino Royale, it is a thinly veiled recreation of what actually occurred in Casino Royale. I mean, in Casino Estoril in 1941. So Casino Royale just mirrors everything that actually happened. So the town Royale is essentially Estoril, and the Brittany Cliffs are the Cliffs of Cascais, and the Splendide and the Hermitage hotels are the Palacio and the Parquet, and they both have fountains, and they both are decorated the same, and they both have red curtains, and they both have a casino next door, and they both have majestic gardens out there. All of that was just recreated identically from Casino Estoril to Casino Royale. And it continues right to what happened in the famous Casino Royale scene, which is the casino scene, which is the heartbeat of the story. That was recreated. Fleming is Mathis, and Popov is Bond, and Le Chiffre was a gentleman named Block. And in both the real life and in the fictional version, the British agent is an MI6 agent, James Bond, Fusco Popov. The agent watching is Mathis, who's really Ian Fleming, and then of course the villains. And in the book version, Le Chiffre is fleeing the Russians. In the real version, which actually happened, Block was fleeing the Nazis. And the money that is bet in real life was MI6 money, and in the story was MI6 money. So it all matches identically what happened in real life to what happened in the fictional version of the novel.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And also, too, you look at the way Ian Fleming originally imagined James Bond. It looked like Popov. It was sort of dark-skinned, dark hair. And I think it sort of, it's not like the James Bond we think of today.
Well, everything matches. In fact, if you look in the back of my book, there's a chart, and I compare all of the people through history who have the most common names that have been suggested as a model or an inspiration for Bond. So I include what we see from Casino Royale, the first James Bond novel, to these potential agents who he could have based it on. And only one matches everything, and that's Dusko Popov. And you start with the physical appearance, which is you had this dark hair combed straight back. And I actually had a blog article where I showed the picture of Dusko Popov. He's having dinner. He's in a tuxedo with Ian Fleming's commissioned sketch of what James Bond looked like. And they're identical. I mean, it looked like the artist was looking at Popov as he was drawing it. But he's got black hair combed straight back, short cropped. Both have blue-gray eyes, not just blue or not just gray, but blue-gray. Both have blue-gray eyes. They're clean-shaven. They're both athletic. They're both good with their hands. Popov speaks five languages. James Bond speaks three. James Bond is a good shot. Popov had just won two shooting contests. It just mirrors it all the way down. So there's no question this was the guy he was basing it on.
That's right. And after Lisbon, Popov ends up in the United States for a while. He was sent there by the Germans, correct?
Yes. The Germans sent him to New York. He was, this is almost hard to believe, he was Britain's greatest agent and he was Germany's greatest agent, or so they thought. They thought he was so successful. MI5, when he goes to visit his controller, his supervisor in Lisbon, Major von Karstorff, MI5 is creating all of these documents and false maps and things that look good. And it's just that either the information was old, it was already public, or they made it just a little bit incorrect. And so that was to deceive them. But the Germans, it looked fabulous. And Popov, you know, the Germans, one of the colonels on the other side said, it looked like the work of 10 men. And as saying that, as Jepson gives him $10,000, says, be so pleased, Admiral Piekenbrock said it looked like the work of 10 men. And Dusko had to be smiling and thinking, well, it kind of was. 10 men that worked for MI5. So anyway, he was their best spy. So they send him, they decide, well, we're going to use him to set up a whole network in the United States. So they send him to New York to start a spy network there, number one, and secondly, to investigate the defenses of Pearl Harbor, which Japan had been asking the Germans to do this for some time. And so they figured that they'll kill two birds with one stone and send Popov to do both tasks. So that's how he ended up in the United States.
It's wedding season. And while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool, cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. But like while he was there, he really wasn't doing anything for the Germans. Seems like he's just spending their money.
You mean when he was in New York?
Yeah, well, yeah, when he was in New York.
Well, he was. If you read my book, you'll see that he was really frustrated because his hands were tied. He's the star agent that the British are just drooling over because he's so good. And, you know, they're thinking, God, this is great. We'll get him to do the same thing in the United States. The problem was Hoover just had every character trait that made it impossible. He was xenophobic. He hated foreigners. He hated spies. So he doubly hated double agents, didn't trust them, didn't trust Popoff. And while Hoover assisted in bringing him in, by contacting the State Department to help get his visa. Once Popoff was in, all he wanted to use him for was bait to catch real other German spies, not to do counter-espionage, just simply as bait. And Popoff just hated that. You know, you've got a thoroughbred, and you're basically using him as a walking horse. And so Popoff couldn't send messages. They wouldn't let him send radio messages. They had the FBI do it. Popoff couldn't see it. It was just the worst case scenario, and they weren't sending any good information. MI5 worked really hard to send good information to the Germans through Popoff that looked absolutely wonderful. It was just wrong, but it wasn't wrong by a lot. It was just, again, like information that happened the day before, so they can't really use it. But when they first see it, it looks brilliant. But Hoover wanted no part of doing any of that. And so the Germans obviously figured out this, God, boy, his work really got bad all of a sudden.
Right. And then you get in the book, and this is kind of interesting too, we won't get into the details, it spoils it, but you know, J. Edgar Hoover's obstructionism with Popoff possibly played a role in Pearl Harbor. And I think that's completely fascinating. Had no idea that this went on.
Yeah. And I'll just, again, you're right. We don't want to spoil the ending, but, or even the middle, but what people don't know, and if you look on the back of the book, there's a blurb that I have from Admiral James Lyons, who is a 4-star admiral and former commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Actually, I have two blurbs from two admirals like that. But Lyons is the admiral that is actually giving the 75th Pearl Harbor anniversary address this year on December 7th. And he knew nothing about this. No one does, basically, but he knew nothing about this. So I've been advising him and giving the documents. But the short version is Topoff warned the FBI on August 18, 1941, almost 4 months before Pearl Harbor, that the Japanese were planning to attack Pearl Harbor. And I won't give the details of what it's all in the book. The documents are in the book. The main document has never been seen before in public, the one that I actually copied out of the FBI files from the National Archives. The Admiral Lyons had not even seen that, knew nothing about it, because Hoover kept it buried. It was all classified. Hoover kept everything buried throughout his entire life and went to his grave with none of this information coming out. There were 8 Pearl Harbor investigations. Not a one knew anything about this document, anything about Popoff's meeting, or anything about Popoff.
It's interesting. Yeah, and you get into the details, and it's really fascinating. But while he's in America, Popoff was potentially, blown, because he's living up to the Playboy stereo, Playboy spy stereotype that he lived. He started a relationship with a movie star named Simone Simon.
That's right.
Yeah, that's her name. And the famous journalist Walter Winchell wrote an article about this. And at this time, too, as you said, Popoff's information he was applying to the Germans was getting pretty crappy. So the Germans were calling him back for an accounting. And this is where the title of your book comes from. You said that this is when Popoff was jumping into the lion's mouth. Why was it so dangerous for Popoff? And what was it about his personality that he was able to, jump into the lion's mouth, but then come out unscathed?
Well, in fact, people always ask where does the title come from, Into the Lion's Mouth? And if you look in the front of the book, between the copyright page and the table of contents, there are 2 quotes there. And the top one, this is where the title comes from. The top one is from Lieutenant Commander Ewan Montague, also with British Intelligence, a colleague of Ian Fleming that had the same office rank, Lieutenant Commander. Montague was essentially one of his case officers. He would meet regularly with Popoff to craft what they called chicken feed, false information to feed to them. For example, like mine charts around Britain, which were wrong, but not wrong by a lot. But if you're bringing a ship in and you think a mine is here and it's not, you avoid this area, and then they're, of course, showing an open area where there actually are mines. So anyway, he worked real closely with Ewan Montague, and Montague said about Popoff this quote: "He had the steel within, the ruthlessness, and the cold-blooded courage that enabled him to go back to the German Secret Service headquarters in Lisbon and Madrid time and again when it was likely that he was blown. It was like putting his head into the lion's mouth." So that's where the quote comes from. So, yeah, you're right. Essentially, the biggest thing that blew his cover was the FBI would not let him send his messages to the Admiral, which he was supposed to do. They were sending it on his behalf, but they don't know all the details. They don't know all the codes. They can't, he's been working for them now for a year, and he's got all of these codes and the way he responds and the information. And so they botch it. So they botch a lot of the information. Hoover doesn't trust him to send codes. He thinks he might be a real German agent. So he never gets to even see the transmitted radio messages going back and forth. So the FBI botches that, and combine that with the fact that they're getting no valuable information. They're like, something's wrong, because he was brilliant for us right up until he went to America. And then all of a sudden it just all drops off. And now, let's see, he's got this girlfriend over there. He's dating this movie star. He's, going to all these parties, because he shows up, as you mentioned. Walter Winchell has this very interesting short blurb in an article. He was nationally syndicated, so this was everywhere, about Simone Simon dating, and her new toy is what they call him, Yugoslav diplomat, and he had a caption, and that's no double talk, which the Germans had to go, what is that all about? Dusko Popov. So anyway, the Germans figured out something happened, and they're pretty sure that he's gone to the other side. in other words, become a double agent. And there are two, the British intercept two messages that show he's blown. So the British said to him when they found out, and it was time, the Germans said, okay, you need to come back and report to Lisbon. The British knew at that point he was blown, and if he went back, he would be tortured and executed. And so they said, you can't go back. You're blown. And he said, well, I have to. I mean, and we know in time that he's the only real great agent that the Germans have or that the British have to deceive the Germans. And, you know, they would eventually need him to deceive the Germans about D-Day. So anyway, so Popov is so courageous, and he says, well, I have to go back. And they're like, no, Dushko, you can't. You'll be tortured. Do you understand? You'll be tortured and executed. And he said to his case officer, Ian Wilson, and his supervisor in MI5, Colonel Tor Robertson, he said to them, well, they won't kill me right away. And his case officer said, you might wish they had.
Right. And
I mean, that's pretty chilling.
That is. I mean, it just shows, I mean, again, it's sort of that James Bond, like, doubles may care attitude he had.
Yeah. And he was just confident. He was so, he had so much confidence. He was so charming. He was so smart that he just believed that once he got back, he could talk his way out of it. He just believed that. He had such confidence. And if he got killed, he got killed. You know, he just knew, look, you know, my job is to help win the war. If I die, I die. So be it. But I'll die in a great cause. So, I mean, just ice water in his veins, this guy had.
Right. And he did make it out of the lion's mouth. We won't tell how, because that's really...
We won't tell how, exactly.
The story is great of how he was able to do that. I mean, going back to some more of this cool spy stuff, you also talk about the OSS... Was it the OSS or British Secret Service, where they had this camp in Scotland where they bring in William Fairbairn, this hand-to-hand like combat expert. Can you tell us about Fairbairn and how, you know, the training that Popov did under him?
Sure. The British decided, this is before there are any commandos or any agents like that that are trained to be commandos. The British decided that they needed basically a fast action, sort of like our Navy SEAL, some group that they could just drop in anywhere that would be these great warriors that could just withstand anything. And so they asked a gentleman by the name of Colonel Gubbins to start this HIT squad commando group, which originally was only going to be about 500 soldiers. And it eventually grew from there. But they said, you start this great commando group that we can just drop in anywhere. And Churchill definitely wanted this. So they founded what was called the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which is essentially like Navy SEALs, just a fast action, get in, get out, wreak havoc, destroy something, capture somebody, kill somebody. And so they set up this very secret, ultra secret training in the middle of nowhere, which was a little town called Arisag, Scotland. And you can actually pull it up online and look at it, and you can see the building that they were housed in is still there. In fact, I had some friends who had their daughter married in that building, but the building is still there, but it's literally in the middle of nowhere. And Govins needed the best of the best for both instruction in hand-to-hand combat and in armaments, rifles, weapons, knives, pistols, machine guns. So he brought in as his main two instructors. The first one was the hand-to-hand combat guy, William Fairbairn, who was, in short, the baddest man on the planet. He headed the Shanghai Police Department, which Shanghai back then was this lawless city with gangs and thugs. And the word was, my research at least estimated, that he had been, at that point, he had been in 600 fights, street fights, knife fights, had scars all over his body, scars on his hands from knife fights. I mean, he was just the baddest guy on the planet. He had gotten a black belt from the founder of judo. And Kano Jigoro was the founder of judo, got a black belt was from him, the first Westerner to do so. He took lessons in jiu-jitsu and aikido and boxing, all these other things. So he was just a walking lethal weapon. So that's who they brought in to train the commandos in hand-to-hand combat, which they did for Dushko. And then they brought in Eric Sykes, who Fairbairn had recruited. He worked for Remington at the time, and Fairbairn recruited him into the Shanghai Police Department, who was the weapons expert. So he was the weapons. He was the guy that would teach them about every single weapon you could find on the battlefield, all the German weapons, the Czech weapons, Polish weapons, everything, Russian. And so they learned how to fire literally any machine gun, pistol, rifle. And then the two instructors, Fairbairn and Sykes, developed a commando knife called a fighting knife. And it's called the Fairbairn Sykes fighting knife, which is basically used by most military and commando groups even today. So that was the knife that they created for them to participate in, you know, knife fights. So that was the guy that trained Popoff. And there's a chapter in the book called The Art of the Silent Kill. And I won't detail how that was done, but it's in the book. And Fairbairn's specialty was the silent kill using your bare hands. And he taught Popoff how to do that.
So this is where Popoff learned to be a 00.
Exactly. Exactly. And in the epilogue of the book, I explained that he earned that 00 the way that Fleming envisioned it.
Right. So, you know, Popoff had an amazing career. You know, he played a role in D-Day. We won't get into the details of that because it's fascinating. And it spoils. Like I said, like we said earlier, this book is a historical book, but it reads like a thriller. That's why we've been like kind of coy with the we don't want to spoil it because like it really does spoil it if you know the ending.
I'll just say that D-Day was the, Popoff was unsuccessful in the U.S. using the information about Pearl Harbor because Hoover ignored it. But he was very successful with D-Day because he did deceive the Germans about, we'll not spoil exactly how he does this, but he deceived the Germans about D-Day so that they thought we were attacking at Calais instead of at Normandy where we did. And they thought that it was going to come in July because that's what Popoff told them. And of course it comes, on June 6th. So he, both for the location and the time, and Popoff did this over, because the Germans are very thorough. So they sent to Lisbon to grill him their best interrogators, SD, Gestapo, ABWAR, their best seasoned interrogators to interrogate him about the Allied plans for the invasion of France. These interrogations would go on 5, 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. And Popoff didn't miss a beat.
So Popoff had this amazing career as a spy. And, you know, he learned how to kill people with his bare hands, did these crazy missions, having to be duplicitous with the Germans, betting, tens of thousands of dollars of British money on Bacharach, lots of relationships with women. Just amazing, just action-filled life. What did he do after the war?
Well, let me just add one thing about it, because you mentioned women. We haven't talked about this. One of the things that James Bond is known for is his suave and successful way with women and womanizing and all of that. Ian Fleming said in an interview, a BBC interview, when he was asked about that, he said, look, my character, James Bond, really only has one girlfriend per book. He only really has one girlfriend per year. Popoff in real life had 2, 3, 4 girlfriends in every city that he went to: Lisbon, Madrid, New York, Rio, everywhere. I mean, and I know because it's in the files. I mean, their names, their love letters. There are all these love letters, because remember, the British would intercept all of the mail to see if they were German secret messages. So they're opening it. So they would get letter after letter. And so in the file, and some of these, I know I put at least one in the book, but you'll see these love letters that are in there. And they're like, who is this? You know, and there were so many when he went to New York, they MI5 had given him a letter from a girl, and Popoff couldn't even remember who it was. He thought it was a German spy girlfriend, but he couldn't even remember. That's how many girls this guy went through. So anyway, okay, back to your question.
So yeah, he had this exciting career during World War II. What did he do after the war?
Well, let me give you two parts. He continued, his cover during the war is as a businessman, as an export-import businessman. And he did it in real life. And unlike if you read Dr. No, you'll see that James Bond coincidentally happens to have the same cover, import-export, which he never does. But in real life, Topoff did. I mean, he actually had to affect business on a day-to-day basis as a businessman. And in the book, I talk about some of the deals, and some were huge. There's a $14 million ship deal. So after the war, he continues his business in export-import in real life and builds this global company where he travels all over the world, still doing his business. He's involved in South Africa and helping their government, doing the bond deal. I mean, he did some really high-powered stuff. The second part is, well, did he continue as a secret agent? And I'll leave that to let people read at the end of the book, because I address it at the end of the book.
Very good. Well, you know, Larry, this has been a great conversation. We've gotten a pretty, bird's eye view of Popoff's career. I'm curious, as you researched and wrote about Popoff, did you glean any life lessons from him on being a man?
Absolutely. I guess I would say probably about four or five different areas where, and a lot of it overlaps to things that you have put in blogs and so forth. And I would just say they were these. Number one, courage. This guy, a man has courage even when he knows that there are great risks of danger to himself and sometimes bodily harm. And Popoff was just one of the most courageous characters that I've ever read about. Like we talked about earlier, he goes back to Lisbon so that he can help defeat Hitler, even though he's been told, you're going to be tortured and executed. That takes, some chutzpah to do that. So he's willing to give his own life for the cause. And so the first lesson on being a man is courage. The second, and this is all over Popoff's career and all over the book, is decision-making. A man makes decisions, and Popoff was very independent. He was his own man and had his own mind, and I think that's important for men to do, is to do your own research, figure it out, do the hard work, and make a decision. This is not a guy that would take a poll. He would not really ask anyone, well, what's your thinking? What's your thought? He would do his own research and make up his own mind and make a decision. And that's a very attractive trait, and something that we as men, really should be doing, is being able to make a decision. And he did that. And, one of the reasons he was a perfect spy was because he could make a snap decision on the spot with the pressure on, and be right. So that would be the second one, is just decision making. The third is, he was a gentleman. He was chivalrous. He had manners. Did he date all of these women? Yes. Some of them actually were German spies, and they were trying to get information from him. So they're using women as bait to try to get, and of course they don't do it. But so he's a gentleman. He knows, in our day, we would say, okay, you open the door for a woman, you stand when a woman comes to the table, and so forth. Those were things that were just ingrained to him, that he was a perfect gentleman. And Simone Simon, who is this famous movie star that he dates, she was one of the top stars in Hollywood at the time, and she absolutely was crazy about him. And in her interviews and things, she would talk about her mom. She lived with her mother she had an apartment in New York, and she stayed in the Beverly Hills Hotel in Hollywood. But when she was in New York, she stayed with her mother. And so Disco is dating her and has to go to, talk to mom while Simone's getting ready. And mom loved him. And even though he's this James Bond, dates all of these women, he was a perfect gentleman with Simone and Simone's mother. And Simone's mother loved him. So he was a gentleman, he was chivalrous, and that's something that, we want to aspire to be as men as well. As I mentioned, he was very well-rounded. I mean, he spoke five languages, he was cultured, he was adept at society, he was a great athlete, he was a reader, he was good with his hands, he could take care of himself. In fact, there's a story that years after the war, he went to the Bahamas and for an interview, and there was a quote unquote bad guy that showed up that was harassing them, and the journalist who I got this information from said Popov, in a calm but very confident manner, basically told the guy, you need to disappear or else. And the bad guy did. I guess Popov was so confident, and just it was clear that he did not suffer fools well or criminals. And the journalist said, I was just stunned because Popov just ran him off just by talking to the guy. And lastly, I would say, you know, part of being a man, he was extremely confident without being arrogant. And there's often a fine line there between being confident and being arrogant. But the, you know, all of the files and all the information that I saw in my research and interviews and so forth, he was extremely confident without being arrogant.
And that's a hard line to it's a hard line to balance on.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about Into the Lion's Mouth?
Well, they can, just for some of the details and so forth, they can look at my website, LarryLoftus.com, or easier to remember, RealJamesBond.com. The book's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart. I mean, the book's everywhere, so they could go online and get it. And all of the review blurbs and stuff are on there, so they could see all that on Amazon, so any of those places.
Excellent. Well, Larry Loftus, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, Brett. Thanks for having me.
My guest today was Larry Loftus. He's the author of the book, Into the Lion's Mouth. You can find that on Amazon.com. Go check it out. It's a historical book that reads like fast-paced spy fiction. You can find out more information about the book at LarryLoftus.com. Also, make sure to check out the show notes at AOM.is/bond. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps us out a lot. As always, I thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.